I was talking last week, a couple of weeks about the Reform, a tremendous success in Germany, Central Europe, and the response of three major rabbonim in Germany, of Bamberg, of Hirsch, and of Hildesheim. And speaking about Rav Shmuel Hirsch a little bit, I mentioned that his pirush on Torah was, in many ways, a revolutionary but a different approach to pirush. And I mentioned several ways that it was unique. Attempt to integrate Torah Shabbat with Torah Shabbat Zav. Its emphasis on the exact meaning of words, the fact that it was written in German. And part of that was, well, much of it was because what Rav Shimshon Hirsch was trying to do was write a Perush on Chumash that could be used to fortify traditional Yahadot against Reform. Especially because something I don't think I mentioned too much last time, something else that was in the air, the cultural air at this time, was biblical criticism. It's not necessarily a Jewish phenomenon, but it certainly helped support what was already, as I explained, a prevalent change in the way that certain Jews wish to study Torah. Study Torah as a science, study Torah as an object of study, rather than as a Torah's chayim. And this approach, the Wissenschaft approach that I mentioned, was supported by the fact that in the general culture at this time, talking about the middle, beginning and middle 1800s, there was a new approach to the Bible in general. So, I'm using the word Bible because that's the word that is used. And that is to look at the Torah, at the Tanakh, and the Old and New Testament as well, as not as a sacred book, but as something to be analyzed and understood. And Goyim, up until this time, certainly up until the Enlightenment, believed in the divinity of the Bible themselves. And Christians believed the Old Testament was divine, but in some way it was superseded by the New Testament. But all this is now changing. And in the 1800s especially, an approach known as Bible criticism began under the initiative of a man named Wellhausen, pronounced Wellhausen, Wellhausen, who developed a theory that there were several authors of the Bible, and that the Bible was not written by God or divinely inspired at all, but it was rather a combination of several people who got together, several ancient people who got together and wrote these works, and then some editor put them all together. And that approach helps explain a lot of problems, which even Chazal are already aware of in the Torah. The most famous one being, there are various parashios in the Torah where God is referred to as Yud-Hei, above, and Hei, and some places where he's referred to as Elohim, some places where he's referred to as both. So Chazal, of course, have an approach, because different names for Hashem mean different things. I'm real familiar with the approach of Chazal and the Mefarshim. But Wellhausen's approach was to say that there are different authors. There's a Jehovist author, an author who is the one who uses God's name, Yud-Hei-Vav-Hei. There is an Elohist author, and that's the author who uses the term Elohim. And this helps them explain various difficulties. And of course, Bible criticism didn't stop there, but had a lot else to say critical of the Bible. Critical here doesn't mean negative to the Bible, but critical here means looking at the Bible with a critical eye, with an eye to explaining it, to scientifically explaining where it came from, etc. And very soon, very quickly, this point of view, biblical criticism, became very widely accepted in Gentile and Goyish religious circles. And to a great extent, it began to be adopted by Jews, especially Reform and Haskalah and the Wissenschaft approach. So that when Reform Shmuel Hirsch wrote his Perush, one of the things that he's trying to do is get back to Tanakh, get back to Chumash especially, and look at it in the eyes of Chazal, and kind of under the surface, often not directly, deal with the challenges that the biblical criticism approach was throwing against the traditional approach. I'm just going to go back over that, because I don't think I mentioned the specific dimension of Hirsch's work as being a way of bolstering, I mean, the traditional approach to Torah against the challenge of the new biblical criticism. We also mentioned last week that a little later on in the 1800s, there are several other works on Chumash that have some of the same objectives and in some cases the same techniques as Rav Shemshon Shmuel Hirsch. And there are at least three such works that are famous ones. There are many more that are less so famous. The three most famous ones, of course, are the Malbim on Chumash, and then the Netzivs, Pirush on Chumash, and a sefer called Haksav v'Hakabbalah on Chumash. The author of the first work, the Malbim, himself historically very interesting. We'll talk about him a little later. And the author of Hamakdavah and the Tziv, another important historical figure we'll talk about later. And the author of the Tzava HaKabbalah's name is Rabbi Yaakov Mecklenburg, who is the Rav of Konigsberg. And he, less famous than the first two, but his Pirush is also written with the objective of trying to integrate, to show how you can't understand Torah Shebaktav without Torah Shebaalpeh. This is a basic point, because that's where Reform challenges us. And here, the attempt is made by so many of us in Gedolei Yisrael to show that the only way you can understand the one thing that we all agree to, and that is Chumash, is by applying Chazal to Chumash. Really might mention Torah Tamima, another such work, though that came a little later still, because the author of the Torah Tamim also had this in mind, of showing how the best perush on Chumash is Chazal. But I don't know if you can call the Torah Tamim a perush on Chumash in the same sense that the Malbim is of Nitzivit. But it had some of the same reasons. To integrate, to show the unity of Torah Shebaktav and Torah Shebaalpeh. I want to leave Germany for a while. I've been focusing on it a long time, mainly because challenge of modernity, the challenge of modernism, was severest in Germany for a number of reasons. And here I think we have to talk a little bit about some social and economic phenomena. The Jews in Germany and Central Europe in general were better off than the Jews in Eastern Europe in the 19th century. Better off politically, they had more freedom. They were better off economically, for sure. They often owned land. They had much more access to economic success, to business. They were wealthier. And they were freer politically. And they also had the tremendous freedom culturally. Because especially in Germany, to a less extent, offered various opportunities to Jews that they never used to have before, especially education, both elementary education and university education. So all of these things were tremendous nisyonos for Am Yisrael. The education, obviously, was a threat to religion, but the politics and the political and economic advantages were threats in a lot of ways. No, as I'll say, that Anius is a big Nisayon and Ashiros is a big Nisayon. In Germany, the big Nisayon was the Osher. Osher with an Aleph and Osher with an Ayin in the 19th century. it becomes almost paradoxical later that Germany, where the Jews were the freest and the wealthiest and the best off, becomes the worst oppressor, oppressor is a mild word, of Am Yisrael. But something we can talk about later. But in this period of time, Germany is a very, very wonderful place. And we saw, we emphasized how all of these three Gdolei Yisrael that we've been mentioning emphasize the value of the German government and the value of the German culture and how important it is to study the German language and literature. It sounds bizarre, looking back from our point of view, that people like this should idealize German culture. So I like to look at, kind of move east to Poland, Lithuania, Russia, and the millions of Jews who are living in those countries in the 18 and 1900s. Still staying there in the early 18 and middle 1800s. What's happening is a tremendous population growth. And in traditional sources, you don't necessarily get a sense of this, but in general historical works, what you find is a tremendous population growth, almost a population explosion of Jews in the areas of Eastern Europe, beginning from the late 1700s on. There are a number of reasons for this. First of all, in general, Jewish families are large. But there are other things that are happening too. And the big one being, and there's a very fascinating article about this recently, in a general work of history, how the fact that there was an improved health condition beginning in the 1800s and the infant mortality rate decreased. Infants survived more to maturity, and this had a tremendous effect on increasing the Jewish population. The Jews tip always have many children, but I don't know how many of us realize that 200 years ago, Jewish parents, if two or three children survived into adulthood out of 10 or 12, it wasn't so extraordinary. Every parent of 7, 8, 9 children figured that 3, 4 of them would die of either an infancy, or, well, die, would never be delivered, would be miscarried, or would die in infancy, or would die from this childhood disease or the other childhood disease, etc. You're always reading stories about the Gdolei Yisrael who were losing children in their young lives. In the early 1800s, because of better health conditions, growth of medical treatment, etc., this started to change. So this is another reason for the increase in the Jewish population. Whatever the reasons are, the fact is that cities like Warsaw, which interestingly enough were almost unheard of as major Jewish population centers. Warsaw is not an ancient Jewish community like Prague is, was, or Frankfurt was. Warsaw, is, up until the early 1800s, is not an important city Jewishly. And then, very, very quickly, it becomes the center of hundreds of thousands of Jews, all in this period of time in the 1800s. However, what's strange is, although Jews are thriving in terms of population, the economic and social conditions of the Jews and political conditions of the Jews in Eastern Europe are, what should we say, atrocious. The poverty is unbelievable, partly because in general these countries were poorer than Germany and Hungary and Central European countries, number one. And number two, the persecutions of Am Yisrael and the limitations upon economic freedom, upon where people could live, where Jews could live. In Russia, there was the famous Pale of Settlement, which was a region. Jews could only live in certain regions and not in others. Jews couldn't live in certain big cities. Jews had to have licenses to practice almost anything, any significant kind of trade. Jews were completely excluded from the educational system. Jews had no vote. On and on and on. The economic, social, political conditions were atrocious. For some reason, that's not so easy to understand, Am Yisrael stayed there. I mean, up until the late 1800s, when with the mass migration to America, but throughout the first half, three quarters of the 19th century, Jews are having a rough time in in the Eastern European countries, but they're not going anywhere. A little later, we'll speak about what's about to happen, 1870s, especially in 1880s, and the migrations, mass migrations of millions of Jews to the United States. So let's stay in Europe for now and just emphasize the terrible economic political conditions in Eastern Europe. Then I want to speak about the major threat, cultural, religious threat,